last case for argument, Reason versus United States, Mr. Lazat.
May it please the court, my name is Paul Lazat and I represent Frederick Reason. Mr. Reason asked this court to vacate his 10-year sentence and remand this matter for resentencing with instructions that he face no more than a 5-year prison sentence. As grounds for this request, Mr. Reason asserts that his previous counsel was ineffective for failing to allege that Mr. Reason's prior Wisconsin conviction lacks a statutory element necessary to trigger penalty enhancement in this case.
Can I ask you, I have one sort of fundamental question here. Since we're here not on the underlying merits, but on ineffectiveness of counsel, as far as I could tell, no court had ever found that 2252b2 was, as you argue, an elements-based kind of statute. And I'm concerned about saying that counsel's performance is substandard when he doesn't make a brand new argument that no one's ever made before. Usually in the ineffective performance cases, we see, you know, that 7 courts of appeals have already ruled that this is an elements-based test and this person just missed the boat. But can you actually say that counsel is constitutionally ineffective for failing to see a new argument?
I believe I can, Your Honor, because I think in this particular case, it's the express language of the statute itself.
No, it's not very express. I mean, they're relating to, and, you know, these statutes, if you look at these federal statutes which are cited here, which are cited in the provision, they're not necessarily tied to minors. Familiar with those statutes?
In Taylor versus United States?
No. In the section we're construing, there's a reference to federal statutes.
Correct, Your Honor. Specific chapters, 109A,
right.
110, 117.
Those are not all about children.
Correct.
Are you aware of that?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. I think in this instance, though, what could have been done with the statute? The statute could have been drafted differently. It could have said a conviction under any state law relating to any prohibited sexual conduct.
Yes, but it incorporates these statutes that are not limited to child conduct involving children. And since the federal statutes that are incorporated aren't limited, why would you impose a limitation on the state statutes?
The reason I would, Your Honor, is that obviously when it incorporates those particular federal chapters, it's elements-based, you simply look to see if there's a conviction underneath any of those particular federal chapters. If there's a conviction under a different federal chapter, the district court is not allowed to go to the underlying conduct to see, well, is this a situation where the conduct that ultimately gave rise to the conviction involved illicit sexual activity with a minor?
Well, that's far from clear, but even if you were right there, you'd still have to you'd have to deal with the language of the statute. Laws of the state relating to aggravated sexual abuse, or sexual conduct involving a minor award.
It really depends where you put commas,
right,
which is why this statute doesn't, I think clear is not a word one would want to use about this statute, because if you think that last clause involving a minor or ward modifies only the words or abusive sexual conduct, which is what it's right after, that's one thing. If it modifies everything, then you have your elements-based
right
argument, but it's, I don't know.
That's obviously
jumping off the page of the statute, it could be read either way.
Yeah, and that's obviously my position, that it modifies the prior clauses as well.
Well, all the way back to the federal statutes?
No. Because I think, you know, in the federal chapter, with respect to the federal chapters...
I don't understand. How do you draw that distinction? Okay.
Well, with respect to the federal chapters, the statute explicitly says if you have a conviction in violation of, came under Chapter 109A, Chapter 110, or Chapter 117, that settled it, a conviction within those particular chapters. That would be my position.
Yes,
if
and?
If the defendant...
What about the state statutes?
Under the state statutes, I think the way the language is drafted, it requires...
Why? Because they don't actually cite the state statutes?
Well, no, because of the language they use. For instance, if they had said a conviction under any state law related to prohibited sexual conduct...
Well, they do. They say aggravated sexual abuse, or abusive sexual conduct involving children.
Correct. And I am reading...
Well, those first two, aggravated sexual abuse and sexual abuse, why don't they correspond to the federal statutes that are cited in the previous clause?
Well, I don't believe they are.
Well, why don't you believe that?
I think the Gallows Court's reading of that was accurate.
Well, would you believe it if it cited specific statutes by, you know, Wisconsin Statute 1322 or something?
Yes, in that instance...
Yeah, well, that's a dangerous concession for you, because it's obvious why they don't cite specific statutes, right?
Right.
You have to cite hundreds of
right.
statutes, right? So
right.
they can't. They have to designate it by category. Well, why wouldn't you assume that aggravated sexual abuse and sexual abuse refer to the state counterpart of those cited federal statutes, which are not limited to
child conduct? I don't, Your Honor, because it would have been very simple to just include the language any prohibited sexual conduct.
But they don't want to include any prohibited sexual conduct. They want aggravated sexual abuse and sexual abuse, which are conventional categories of state law. But they can't cite every state statute, so they use the name for that statute. And if you want symmetry between that and the way they treat the federal statutes, you would say that it doesn't, if it's, as long as it's sexual abuse, it doesn't matter whether it's a minor involved. In any event, getting back to Judge Wood's point, it's hard to fault a lawyer for maybe you can fault him, but it's hard to condemn him for being unprofessional, for failing to make an uphill fight.
Well, in this particular case, Your Honor, I do think it was deficient performance, because I think the record shows that the only significant issue was going to be sentencing.
But the thing about that is, I mean, this lawyer was operating against the background. What year was the sentencing?
Late 2000,
yeah,
December 2000.
Well, our decision, our in-bank decision in Shannon, for example, had been several years before that. And there, and in subsequent cases, we had said, you know, sure, we don't want lots of mini-trials. We don't want lots of extraneous things in a case. But if a conviction is used for enhancement purposes and you can tell by the nature of the statute, or, as we've said in later cases, there's uncontested, no need for a hearing, absolutely uncontested evidence that the prohibited matter is covered, then you can use it for the enhancement. So this lawyer, if they were thinking about it, might have thought that and might have said, well, here, we didn't see Mr. Rezin contesting that the description from the state's attorney that appears on page A32 of your brief was wrong. He seems to have conceded that. And as long as he conceded that, then even the minor, to the extent there's doubt about it, even that occurs, because we've got dates of birth and conduct.
Correct, Your Honor, but I do believe in this case, since sentencing was going to be the key issue, counsel should have carefully read 2252B2.
But if he had done so and then he read Shannon and Jiang, wouldn't he have come to the conclusion that the enhancement was proper?
I don't believe so, and moreover, I don't see what risk, you know, what there was to lose by raising the issue. The worst that could have happened would have been the district court says, no, you're reading the statute incorrectly, and then the issue is preserved for a direct appeal.
Well, wait, but a lawyer doesn't have, well, anyway. Can you think of a reason why a sentencing court should not consider this uncontested fact of the victim's age?
Well, I think it does come into consideration in terms of application of the sentencing guidelines. But again, you know, obviously I'm reading the statute in a way...
No, but statutes are supposed to make some minimal sense, usually. What would be the sense of saying, well, we know it was a 13-year-old or whatever, but can't consider it? Well, why would Congress say that to the courts?
Because the rule I'm advocating for would provide a uniform application. You look at the fact, is there a conviction? Is it a conviction under a state statute that would trigger...
I don't understand you. Why would Congress say to the courts, we don't want you, even if everybody concedes it's a 13-year-old or a 2-year-old or whatever, we don't want you to consider that fact?
Well, I think that logic would equally apply to a situation where there was a deferred prosecution.
That's not my question. What's the sense of that? Why do that? Can you think of a reason why that would be sensible penal policy?
Well, they have the uniform application of simply looking to the elements, and that could be an element.
Well, why? But there's no complexity here because the fact is conceded. So why should the sentencing court close its eyes to it?
Or it could be arbitrary with respect to the particular defendant before.
Why
the court.
Is it arbitrary? If you're being prosecuted for child molestation of some child pornography or something like that, and your previous sexual offenses involve children, why isn't that highly material?
It's material.
In fact, you could say the real uniformity requires, you know, considering the punishing more severely people who have a history of child sexual offenses rather than people who don't.
I can understand the desire to impose that, but with respect to the defendant where the record is not as clear, or a defendant who's unwilling...
Sure, but we don't have that case, so why should we worry about that here? Or why, specifically, why should Congress have said, no matter how clear, uncontested, etc., the fact is, and how material to the sentence that this person should receive, you can't consider it?
I would say to avoid unfairness to the defendant in this particular case, as opposed to the defendant.
Why is it unfair for him to be punished more heavily than someone who has a previous record but that doesn't involve children?
Well, I guess what I'm driving at is there is another defendant who's engaged in the same type of activity, and the prior state record is not as clear.
Well, it wasn't caught.
Correct.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Azad. Mr. Rumbelo?
May it please the court, Rita Rumbelo on behalf of the United States. As this court has observed, 2252b2 is anything but clear, but the portion of the statute that is clear is the portion that we are dealing with, and that is that Mr. Rezin has a prior conviction relating to abusive sexual conduct involving a minor.
But, you know, your brief focused on this word conduct, but it's preceded by the words the laws, and the laws, if what we're supposed to do is look at the set of behaviors or conduct that the law covers, that takes you to an elements-based test. I mean, you can't just pull the word conduct out of the air and treat it as something that has no referent under the laws relating to all these different things, aggravated sexual abuse and so on. And what's the difference between sexual abuse and abusive sexual conduct? Is there actually a difference? I have no idea. But I think sexual abusive conduct is broader.
It's a confession.
No, it's
and
broader.
And you're incurious also about what sexual abuse is?
I mean,
you said this part of the statute is clear. What part is unclear in your mind?
The interplay between the federal statutes and the state statutes that the court was referring to earlier.
Isn't that a relevant unclarity?
Pardon me?
Why isn't that a pertinent unclarity?
Because in this case, we have been looking solely at whether or not Mr. Rezin has a prior conviction for sexual conduct involving a minor.
But you're omitting the key word. It's whether he has a conviction under the law of a state relating to abusive sexual conduct involving a minor. And your opponent says this particular Wisconsin statute doesn't say a word about the person being a minor. So how can it be a law of the state relating to being a minor? Certainly, you can look beyond the face of the statute, and we have this extra page. That's not Mr. Raisin's words. Those are the words of the prosecuting state attorney. And it may be a relevant fact that Mr. Raisin hasn't contested them, that the state law under which he was convicted is not one of those laws that protects children. It's a generic law.
It is the government's position that this statute is not an elements-based test when you compare it to other statutes written by Congress. If you look at...
But why should you invite courts to have to conduct many trials about what lies behind every former state conviction that's being used to figure out what set of behaviors led to that particular conviction? That would be a nightmare.
It would be a nightmare, and that is not what the government is proposing. This is a conduct-based test.
The government conduct-based test take you where we don't want to go.
It can, but it doesn't in this case. It didn't in this case.
But that means, so you're really arguing for a rather complex interpretation, which says that conduct involving a minor, if it's conceded.
No, in this case, it was clear on the face of the charging document.
Or if it's clear, but if it's unclear, so that you're doing a lot of, you want us to do a fair amount of work on the statute.
You're looking to the charging document?
Yes, the charging document in this case was an information that clearly set forth the victim's date of birth. We didn't have to conduct a mini trial. Whether or not that would be...
The rule you want us to adopt is to look at the charging document in these cases? The state charging document.
Of course, we didn't want to do that in Shannon because the actual plea that followed the charging document didn't require concession of every last detail that was in that case, a criminal complaint, as I recall. And so we said the only thing we can really look at is what's on the face of the judgment, which did happen to reveal the victim's age, another case about minors.
And in this case, the face of the judgment did not include the victim's age, but the charging document did. Again, it was uncontested. And as the court noted, it would be implausible to think that Congress intended us to ignore the fact that a defendant has a prior conviction involving sexual conduct and a minor.
Of course, you do have a clue in the judgment of conviction. It may have been about minors because one of his conditions is no business with children 16 years or younger unless supervised.
That's
so
correct.
So he's got a signal, if you will, that he's aware.
It's not explicit, but it's very implied in the judgment. But more importantly, as Judge Wood noted at the outset, we are here on a 2255. Mr. Raisin has not established cause.
But he made a good point, which is that if you have only one argument for your client, and it's not a great argument, is it really responsible for a lawyer to say to himself, well, I think that argument is unlikely to succeed, and even though it's the only argument my client has, I'm not going to make it. Is that actually responsible advocacy?
I can't speak to defense counsel's advocacy in this particular case.
I don't understand you. You have to if you want to follow up on Judge Wood's point, right? Did he have other arguments?
Did he have any other?
You say a lawyer shouldn't, trot out a lot of marginal arguments. He should concentrate on his best arguments. Did the lawyer here have some other better argument to make for his client?
I do not believe the record reflects that. No, I don't
think
he had any other argument.
Okay, this was his only shot. It was a long shot. But if you fail to take a long shot for your client, why isn't that sub-professional?
Under Shannon and Zhang, it was not even a long shot.
Well, if you were in front of Judge Shabazz and you wanted to say, forget about the fact that there had been a prior juvenile sexual content, you can't think about that. How do you think that would fly? How do you think that would affect the tenor of the sentencing hearing?
I don't understand your question.
Was he before Judge Shabazz?
Yes, it was.
And if your argument, as defense counsel was, all right, we've got this other conviction, we all know it involved a minor, but forget that and put it out of your mind, that can't be considered, how would that fly? Would that be good advocacy as a defense counsel? What kind of range, what end of a range do you think you might get if you made that argument?
Well, here, there was the applicable guideline range really wasn't relevant because there was the statutory mandatory minimum. So there was a
maximum.
Restricted guideline
maximum.
Range. Pardon me?
You mean maximum.
Maximum. Are you... Are you suggesting that if counsel had made that argument, it may have affected where he would have been sentenced
might have
within
been
the
worse.
Applicable
might
guideline range?
The question is, was there a downside to making this argument? It could be, as Judge Kaney suggests, you know, might lead to a higher sentence by angering the judge, or it might cause the judge to overlook some better argument, something of that sort. But I take it from what you say, you're not really arguing that there was some downside that made it reasonable for the lawyer not to make this argument.
Well, how could there be a downside if he got the statutory maximum on a single count complaint, or, you know, charge?
I didn't suggest it, but I was just trying to understand Judge Kaney's question.
The Judge Wood saying that's the reason is
there's
no downside because he got the maximum anyway.
Right. But again, we don't know.
But you didn't know what he was going to get.
And we still don't know what went through Attorney Skemp's mind because petitioner has never asked for an evidentiary hearing in this matter. He never tried to expand the record outside the sentencing hearing. So we just don't know what was going through Attorney Skemp's mind at the time of the sentencing hearing. That is something that petitioner failed to develop.
Right, but you're not suggesting that he might have had a tactical reason. Pretty improbable.
I can't even guess again what was going through the attorney's mind at the sentencing hearing, and without a request for an evidentiary hearing, we will never know. But again, in view of the established set of circuit case law, it's completely reasonable, and it is not deficient performance for him failing to raise this issue at the sentencing hearing. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Rumbelow. Mr. Lassat, how much time does he have? No more time? We can have a minute if you have anything further.
Just wanted to add, Your Honor, I believe that in the 2255 petition, I did request an evidentiary hearing before Judge Shabazz, and he denied the motion without a hearing, just saying that the legal argument was invalid, so counsel could not have been ineffective for failing to raise it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel, and court will be in recess until 9:30.